Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
I'm Evan Klein at Evangeline Cafe, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. The salmon fisheries have been closed down this year in order to let the fish come back. I'll talk to a fisherman today about why he supports this and how it affects his livelihood, how to cure cavities by giving kids lollipops, and how to turn cow poop into energy and cat poo into coffee. I'm really serious. But first, we're off to the Santa Monica Farmers Markets to see what's in season now.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting with DJ, who is the chef at Lou Wine Bar. DJ's here at the market every single week shopping, and we're trying to catch something that's in season, that's going to be super good to cook right now. And DJ, we couldn't help but notice these gigantic artichokes at Green Farm. Can you tell us a recipe that a home cook like us could use these for?
Sure. They have two kinds there. They have the big globe. The globe artichokes, they look like almost like footballs.
They're huge.
Huge. And then they have the little tiny ones. The globe ones are nice because they have a gigantic heart on them. And I'm like the Italians, I just go for the heart. So I peel away all that to get down to the base of it. And a really simple way to use it, once you've peeled away all of the leaves and the choke, and of course rubbed it with lemon juice because it'll discolor. It's just to slice them very thinly and put extra virgin olive oil on them. And they're delicious that way. Also paired up with avocado, because it's a nice textural component difference. You got that creamy avocado, and then you got the crisp bite. Or sometimes they're nice to do just with shaved fennel. So that's like a totally simple way to do it.
Now, DJ, is that raw? Just raw?
Yeah, absolutely. Raw artichokes are really great that way.
Okay, and after you've rubbed it with the lemon, is there a dressing that you would put on all those things together? What do you dress
them
with?
Well, if I'm going to serve them raw, I just have a really good extra virgin olive oil, like one that you would use for finishing, and good lemon. Meyer lemon is really nice because it's a little bit sweeter than the Eureka lemons that we get here.
And on the big artichokes, I know that part of the stem, the heart kind of continues. Do you keep any of the stem, or are you just using just that heart that's right there at the top of the stem?
Well, the heart does continue all the way down the stem. Uh-huh. So the nice thing about the ones at Green is they're like a foot and a half long. I cut off the stem and then cut them into about a 4-inch baton, mm-hmm. and then set it up on end. And then you just run your knife along the edge of it until you get it out. But I should point out that they'll discolor right away. So that's why I put a lot of lemon juice and water. And then we can store them that way. And even if they discolor a little bit, the heart discolors, you can just peel a little bit of that off before you do it. But it's a really nice way that I think also if you add Parmesan cheese to that, fennel, artichoke, and Parmesan cheese, uh-huh. extra virgin olive oil, squeeze a lemon, a little bit of fleur de sel, it's delicious.
Oh, that sounds delicious. So good. And then what about the little artichokes?
Little artichokes are great for braising. Since there's no choke on them, all you need to do is just peel away those outer leaves until you get to the green part, and then the little top part of it will be purple, and I just slice that off, and then I peel around the base with a knife, so you're exposing the hard part, cut them in half, and then you can braise them with meats. What I like to do is just heat up some olive oil, throw some shallots in there, and then quick saute them, and then I put a little bit of Madeira over the top, or any kind of like sort of sweet wine, and just let that reduce away, and they're just great like that. You can put a little parsley over the top of them. Quite delicious with little baby potatoes, and they're terrific with like lamb, maybe a leg of lamb that you roasted, or maybe roasted chicken. They're just delicious.
And it's interesting, you were mentioning your restaurant is Lou, and they're known for their wine and their pairings and stuff, and you were saying how hard it is to pair artichokes with wine.
Well, there are wines, obviously, the Italians have a huge artichoke cuisine and drink wine with it, but it does tend to make wines either more sour or more bitter.
DJ, it's always good to catch up with you and hear what you're cooking and what your inspiration is. And we enjoy seeing you here every week at the market.
I love this place. It's the best place to shop.
Great. And tell us where Lou is located.
Lou's 724 North Vine Street, half block north of Melrose on Vine, on the east side of the street, little strip mall next to a laundromat.
Thanks so much. That was DJ, who is the chef at Lou, which is a little hole-in-the-wall wine bar tucked away right there near Melrose. And DJ's here every week, and he's always got great ideas to share with us at the market. I'm visiting now with Doa Herr, who is the son of one of our Hmong farmers who comes down from Fresno at the Wednesday market here. And I couldn't help but notice today on your table, Doa, you've got beautiful basil, two kinds of basil. Can you tell us about that?
There's actually like four different kinds. There's a purple basil. It's not as strong as the Italian basil. And then the Italian basil is just a regular basil. And then there's a Thai basil. It has a little stronger flavor than the Italian basil. And then we have the lemon basil, which has a nice aroma to it.
Mm-hmm. Basil is very sensitive to the weather, so you have to wait till it warms up a little bit to bring it. Is this the first couple of weeks you've been bringing it here?
Yeah, we grow them in a greenhouse. That's why we're able to have it like this early in the season.
And that's a big bunch of basil there. And how much are those?
It's $2
for a big bunch.
Yeah.
And then how do you guys cook with them at your family?
We use a lemon basil to like steam it with fish. We stuff the fish with other kinds of herbs and lemon basil. Other than that, we use the Thai basil in soups, noodle soup.
And let's talk about, you've also got the amaranth, which is a really popular green. Can you first of all describe what it looks like and then tell us how you use it in cooking?
We just steam it, just kind of eat it with salt and maybe soy sauce, but it's really nice. The leaves are green, and then inside there's purple reddish leaves in it too, so it looks nice. And when you cook it, the red stuff, it comes out and it kind of stains the dish red, like purple.
And amaranth it's got really good nutritional properties, right? People like it for its nutritional value. And is it similar to spinach in flavor at all?
That's what I hear. My mom tells me it's like a Chinese spinach.
Okay. And then your whole table is just loaded with all kinds of great Asian vegetables, such as the bok choy. And then what's this one right here that
this is tok choy.
Tok choy, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then everything else from A to Z, and your table is just beautiful.
Thank you.
That was Doa Herr, and he is a Hmong farmer who comes down from Fresno with his family. And they have wonderful, tender, fresh basil right now, lots of other kinds of greens, and very interesting Asian vegetables in general. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Is listening to talk about food enough? I say no. Watching is the next best thing to eating, which is why I have a new video for you to chew on. In it, I'll show you how to make these easy and delicious leek fritters, just perfect for springtime. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood and download the video. You can find it on iTunes as a video podcast too. Before we eat, I thought we should meditate on the many etiquette rules that surround consuming food. For instance, is it wrong to hide ingredients from your food-restricted friends? This and other passive-aggressive acts we reserve for our loved ones. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Found yourself in a situation where you're preparing a meal for somebody close to you, somebody you like, and you realize they have a dietary restriction and you've already made the meal. And maybe there's something in there that you shouldn't have put in to make them feel better. Is it ever acceptable to hide things in food? Well, with us today to muse on this thorny subject is Helena Eichlin. She does the weekly column called Table Manners at Chow.com. So is it ever acceptable to hide things in food?
Well, firstly, I think that we should make it very clear that it is not acceptable to hide things in people's food if you're violating their religious beliefs or ethical beliefs. For instance, you could never you know, give a vegan some soup with chicken stock in. But there is a certain amount of subterfuge that it is okay to indulge in. Like, let's say you have a brother who's an anchovy hater, and but you know that just throwing in like one or two anchovies is going to make your pasta sauce so much better, and the anchovy will just melt into the sauce and make it all, give it some nice umami. I think that's okay. And I think what people should resist is when you feed your brother this pasta, I think people have this impulse, you have this impulse afterwards to say, guess what that had in it? I think there's an element of gloating there. And so my position, what I think about this is, it's okay to hide these kinds of things in food, but what you shouldn't do is say, guess what?
I think it's funny because I imagine that that brother, the anchovy hater, would taste the sauce and would come back and say, you know, I can, every time I make that sauce, I can never make it taste that delicious. What is it that you put in it that makes it that delicious? Then I think you can reveal.
Yes.
But I understand you yourself were the victim of a reveal on the part of your husband.
Yes. It was a low point in our relationship, I feel. One of his students had made him a gift of fudge. It was Christmas time, so he brought home this fudge. And I don't really like fudge that much, but I tried some of it because it was a gift. And then my husband goes to me, guess what the secret ingredient is? You know those words that make people's hearts sink? The answer was Velveeta cheese.
Of course. This fudge recipe is sweeping across America.
Well, Kraft Foods invented this recipe. It's on their website. And so I screamed with rage and tried to throw the fudge in the trash. And he wouldn't let me because he was like, this is a homemade, something someone made for me and I'm not going to throw it away. But then we were going to a friend's house that night, so we took the fudge with us, and everyone thought it was delicious. And they were like, is this homemade? And I was just like,
Oh, my. But what about if you have a friend coming over who's on a diet? Maybe it's a friend who's always on a diet, much like myself, for example. And you know that they're trying to avoid simple carbohydrates. But something's happened with your sauce and you need to bind it. So you add a little something to make it smoother, prettier. Do you feel that you have to confess about that?
That is a very tricky question. And I think many people would say, you know, if they're on a diet, then definitely should be upfront. But personally, I feel, and I know this is going to be controversial, personally, I feel that if you just put a little, like a tablespoon of breadcrumbs, it won't really make that much difference to their diet. I guess what I'm saying is ultimately it's more important, I believe, to have a lovely meal with a delicious sauce than to avoid, you know, this minute infringement of your dietary restrictions.
And in fact, when you wrote this column for Chow.com, were you surprised at the number of responses you got?
There was just a tidal wave of rage. It was all the columns that I've ever written, this was one of the two that made people the angriest. They actually started a message board to discuss the value of Helena's future.
Oh gosh, that's
which I thought
awful.
Sounded like they were going to dispatch someone to kill me. But I think that that emotion comes from when you allow somebody to feed you, it's an act of trust. And when you discover that they've violated that trust, it can be very upsetting,
but
I guess.
You know, I feel that this is a really good place to discuss the difference between Americans' need for control over what they eat and perhaps the way people eat in the rest of the world when they're in a group setting, when food is being offered from one person to another, which is, you know, in most cultures considered to be a great, generous, beautiful thing, breaking bread together. And I just think that sometimes if we're not talking about allergies or religious or ethical things, I think we should just get a life. What about you?
I mean, to me, like the gift of having somebody make you a homemade meal is way more important than temporarily like breaking your dietary restrictions. Just to add one final thing, I think people go to restaurants a lot. Restaurants, I mean, as I understand it, use a lot of fat in their cooking, and I think people are in denial about that. Or they're willing to kind of overlook it when they go out to eat. So when they go over to people's houses, you know, maybe they should just not need to know all the ingredients in the same way.
Chow.com is where you can find Helena Eichlin's weekly etiquette column. If you've got an opinion on this, go to our new Good Food blog at kcrw.com/ Good Food and post your opinion or maybe even a confession. Coffee lovers are so devoted. There are all kinds of coffee connoisseurs who know all about the roasts, the types of beans, where they were grown, everything. We heard about one of the most expensive cups of coffee ever. And you'll never believe that it came out of the backside of a cat. Or a cat-like creature, if that makes you feel better. Good Food producer Thea Challoner took a trip for this coffee with frequent guest Eddie Lin, also known as the Deep End Diner. Stay tuned. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com.
How far would you go for a great cup of joe? For those in the know, look no further than the excrement of a civet cat. Asian palm civets found on the island of Sumatra in Indonesia have discriminating taste. They hang out in trees eating only the very best cherry coffee berries, which pass undigested through their system. Key point. Someone, clearly someone with a real sense of adventure, noticed these undigested berries in the cat's waste and had a brilliant idea. Coffee. This delicacy is known as Kopi Luwak, and it's being served right here in Santa Monica by a man named J.C. Ho, owner of a coffee house called Funnel Mill. Eddie Lin, the Deep End Diner himself, joined me for a taste.
Welcome to our little coffee house.
Yeah, I'm really
Funnel Mill is more like an upscale spa than a coffee house. There's a small fountain and a handful of lounging customers looking very serene. Prominently displayed above a couch is a painting of a civet cat sitting on a coffee cup reading the newspaper. There's a caption that says,
Luwak, we need another cup of coffee. And the Luwak response coming out.
Oh my God, that's great. This, I already love this guy, this little civet cat. So essentially this coffee, I mean, it looks like a turd, right?
Right.
What does it look like? I mean, do you clean it off?
Well, if you go to our website, you will literally see a color picture of the civet cat. Right next to it, you'll actually see a fresh dropping turd.
If you really want the visual, the turd looks a lot like a Rice Krispies treat. Clearly, Kopi Luwak is not for everyone. Outside of the turd issue, it's also $65 a cup. So JC has an extensive customer screening process.
What do you like about coffee? What flavor are you looking for?
I drink coffee to wake me up in the morning, but I also love the richness and the little bit of bitterness. I like to put cream in my coffee, so I love the creaminess.
Based on what you're telling me, you pretty much like your coffee with cream. But would you have a problem to drink a very smoky cup of coffee, black, with no sugar, no cream added?
Did I say I like cream? I hate cream. I hate it. I like my coffee black.
Cream actually masks the complexity of the taste, JC explains.
I'm not a coffee or tea Nazi. You can do whatever you want to do. But there are a couple beans that I'm very protected that I don't serve cream with it. Kopi Luwak definitely is one of them.
Before he makes us a cup, JC lets us know what we're in for.
Initial taste, since it's fresh brew, is very smoky. And you'll taste a little bit of citrusy, a little fruitiness on the very left and right side of your tongue. Then the nutty flavor comes out. As you're drinking it, the fruitiness actually amplifies.
He grinds the beans, then takes out a vacuum pot called a siphon. Two glass globes connected by an airtight seal sitting over a small Bunsen burner. The water boils in the bottom globe, then is forced through a tube to the upper container full of ground coffee. At that point, JC takes a plastic tube full of oxygen, just like the one they put in your mouth at the dentist, and begins to pump in tiny oxygen bubbles. Brewing time is between 40 and 60 seconds. Then the coffee is sucked back down into the bottom globe, ready to drink.
You know, I honestly can't taste anything. Like, I'm expecting some funky aftertaste or some kind of flavor that would make me think, okay, yeah, I know why this is, you know, civet cat coffee. But it tastes like a really well-brewed, really flavorful cup of high-quality coffee. I'm really getting a nice caffeine kick.
This is Eddie, after half a cup.
You know, I feel so wired right now, but I feel good. I feel happy. I'm not shaking. I'm not jittery. It's almost like a nice buzz, but energy, you know. I have kind of this energetic buzz.
And this is Eddie, after he finished that cup.
I feel like I'm on something. This isn't... No, but something good. I'm high on life, but life is accelerated. It's like I can't slow down.
If you'd like to try a cup of Kopi Luwak for yourself, check it out at Funnel Mill Rare Coffee and Tea, 930 Broadway, Suite A, Santa Monica. For Good Food, this is Thea Chaloner.
That was Good Food producer Thea Chaloner with Eddie Lin, the Deep End Diner. I'll have all the info on this intriguing cup of coffee at kcrw.com/goodfood. The popularity of salmon is nuts, just really out of this world. But that's just one of the factors for the massive decline in the salmon fisheries along the West Coast. Because of the lack of fish in these areas, the salmon fisheries have just been closed for this season. It's a dramatic closure, one that will have wide-reaching economic effects on the economy. I'll be back next with a fisherman to talk about the closure and how it'll affect him personally. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Just push that button. For those of you who rely on salmon to give you your weekly doses of good omegas, you might be in for a disappointment. Commercial salmon fishing off the coast of both California and Oregon is canceled for this year due to a record low number of salmon. So we've invited a fisherman, Mike Hudson, to talk with us today about how we got here and the impact this decision will have on him in particular and other salmon fishermen. So first of all, I guess I have to ask if you agree with the decision to close the waters to commercial salmon fishing this year.
Oh, absolutely. The numbers of salmon were so low that we couldn't afford to lose one of them. Our salmon numbers are down from about 800,000 salmon about 4 years ago to an estimated 50,000 salmon, and if we caught one of these fish, that would be a terrible thing.
Wow. Now, just to give us a better understanding of what's happening, can you tell us a bit about the cycle that a salmon goes through during its life?
Well, the salmon are born in the river. They live in the river for a couple of months or something like that, depending on the species. Then they slowly migrate out towards the ocean. And after about 3 years, sometimes 4 years, they come back to the river to spawn and die.
So they live out in the sea, which is what gives them their incredible health and vigor and omegas, and then they come back. Which rivers are we talking about?
Well, the three major rivers along the West Coast are the Columbia River, which used to, at one point, sustain about 16 million salmon annually. And we're down to about 500,000 in a good year now. The next river, as you go south from the Columbia, would be the Klamath River, which used to sustain about 1 million salmon every year. And we have a hard time getting 35,000 salmon back into that river. And the next river, which has been the biggest salmon-producing river on the West Coast, is the Sacramento River. And we need a minimum of 130-some thousand fish in order to keep the species going, and we're at less than half of that this year.
So what does this mean for you?
That means for me I'm out of work, and not only for this year, but probably for next year too.
Now, give us an idea of the scale on which you fish. You're not a huge fisherman. You're what they call a small boat fisherman. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, and that's what essentially all the fishermen along our coast are. We're all little family-owned operations. I have a 38-foot boat, and I fish for about 3 days and come in on the fourth day usually. And I deliver my fish to my wife, who brings them over to the farmer's market, where we sell them directly to the people.
How did the fish population decline so much?
It's not anything that's related to overfishing. When you look at the facts, that 99% of all the salmon die in the rivers before we even get a chance to fish for them. And even though we weren't fishing hard, the Sacramento salmon have declined by over 90%. So the problem is definitely in the river, and it's related to our water diversions. It's related to our dams and pollution and all these factors that affect these fish.
Talk a little more about water diversions. What do you mean by that?
In California, just for example, we used to export about 5 million acre feet of water every year from the Sacramento Delta down to mostly farms in the Southlands. And in recent years, we have ramped up that pumping from these Delta pumps to about 6.4 million acre feet a year. So we're exporting a third more water than we used to do, and we see that all the fish in the delta are experiencing really, really steep declines, not only the salmon, but also the delta smelt and the shad.
What do you see as a long-term solution for this?
The long-term solution is there's a lot of unsustainable farming practices. Our poster child right now, for example, is cotton grown in the desert of Central California. That takes up an incredible amount of water. You know, we need to quit pumping so much water out of the delta, because the water that flows from the rivers to the ocean is important. We used to think back in the day that the water that we let go into the ocean was wasted water, and it really isn't. You know, it sustains a lot of life, not only our salmon, but all kinds of other populations of animals. By keeping on pumping that water out, we destroy the whole food chain of our estuaries, of our rivers, and our oceans. There's over 200 species that depend on salmon for their diet. If we let our salmon go away, all of these other species will go away. Dams are a very big concern. We're blocking off thousands and thousands of miles of spawning habitat for these fish. And we're trying to mitigate these impacts with hatcheries, and the hatcheries work well enough to keep us going, usually, if all the other factors work out fine. But we're seeing right now that the hatcheries themselves are not enough.
So what's going to happen to the economy that's based on all of you, a small boat salmon fisherman? I would imagine it doesn't just affect you, but it must affect tackle shops and the places that fillet the fishes?
It's a really hard blow to our whole infrastructure. Okay, let's say we go back fishing in a couple of years. During that time, our fuel docks, our ice docks, will have a really hard time staying in business. The help that we need after the fish is being caught, for example, a fish filleter is a very, very skilled position, especially when you're talking about fish that has a value of about $20 a pound for fillets. Little gas stations like along the Klamath River, for example, hotels along our coast, our whole coastal community will hurt very, very badly.
I understand that you've gotten together with a group of other salmon fishermen to put together salmon aid.
That is correct. We have formed over the last half year pretty much the largest coalition of salmon supporters on the whole West Coast. We're a group of commercial fishermen, sport fishermen, tribal fishermen who live along the rivers, and environmental organizations who work really hard on the restoration of our rivers.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Mike. Mike Hudson is a fisherman based in Berkeley, California. He's also the president of the newly formed Salmon Aid Foundation and hopes to publicize the issues that lead to this dramatic closure. The first annual Salmon Aid Festival takes place on May 31st and June 1st at Jack London Square in Oakland. I've got links to the organization at kcrw.com/goodfood. You know, a lot of people drive by 99-cent stores and think that there's only aisles full of supermarket rejects. But don't be so fast to judge. There's a feast to be had in those aisles. Shopping on the cheap. Stay with us. Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com will be right back. So if you're like me, then your weekly rounds to accomplish varying grocery tasks involve stopping at a lot of different stores. But have you thought of adding your 99-cent store into these rounds? Well, Julie McKinnon thought that she might try making a meal of 99-cent items. She wrote a great article for the LA Times, and we're happy to have her here this morning. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Evan.
What made you start thinking about the 99-cent store as a food resource? Because I think the last time I went there, the food items were very bizarre, like weird canned things from Bulgaria.
Right.
I think I saw actually a whole canned chicken there once, which was the strangest food item I think I'd ever seen.
I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, my mom taught me to be a bargain hunter, so I always would go to the 99-cent store for toilet paper and stuff like that. And so I noticed about maybe a year and a half ago, they started having more and more produce. And there was dairy cases where there weren't dairy cases before. So I started looking. I thought, wow, this is pretty impressive. You know, I mean, I was getting milk there. I was getting cheese. I was getting avocados. And
now, were the expiration dates normal?
Occasionally, I've seen a few things in there that are expired, but not, you know, we're talking like a week or two past on a bag of crackers or something. So
you got this idea for actually creating a meal using these items exclusively from the 99-cent store.
Right.
How did this come about?
Los Angeles has some of the highest food prices in the country, even though we're very close to farms and the port and everything. So we were talking about ways we save money, and I was saying to people, oh, well, do you know the 99-cent store has actually has some good food there? And people said, huh? You know, I wouldn't eat food from the 99-cent store. Isn't it all expired? Isn't it all like chickens in a can? So I said, well, I'm going to show you guys. So the article came about.
How does food end up at the 99-cent store?
Various reasons. Some of the food is actually grown for them. They have contracts with producers to regularly supply them with certain items. And they have store brands of stuff like soy milk. And other times, if a producer has too much, they call the 99-cent store and say, hey, can you take this lot of cherry tomatoes? We have, you know, 5 cases too many. Other times they change the packaging. And when you go into your Ralph's, you don't want to see 2 different kinds of cans of Pringles. You know, you want to have 1 kind.
Oh,
there.
So when the manufacturer changes, they sort of sell off the
right.
old edition.
Right. And some of them are test products that don't really work.
So how did you go about deciding on your menu?
Well, you have to be sort of open to serendipity because you never know exactly what they're going to have. When I went in for the article, I went with a date and we went and
okay, you went with a date. Had you ever dated this person before?
Only a couple times. So this was sort of a little test to see, you know, how much he could tolerate of my quirkiness. But he was a very good sport about it. We found eggs and cheese and I found a frozen pie crust. So immediately we started thinking about quiche. And he talked me into some mechanically separated turkey bacon.
Mechanically separated from what? Was it separated?
I don't know, but I got an email later from someone who assured me that all turkey bacon is mechanically separated. And I just thought maybe the manufacturer had second thoughts about including that in very large type on the packaging.
So what did your meal consist of?
We had some oysters from a can. That was my date's contribution.
On a toothpick, or did you do anything fancy with them?
Just on a toothpick. And we had some salad. They often have bagged greens there, hearts of romaine, sometimes even organic. cherry tomatoes, cucumbers you can find, peppers of all sorts, salad dressing, of course. And we had quiche. And then I bought a box cake mix and some powdered sugar and some milk. And we made frosting and cupcakes. And I don't think I'm going to win any Michelin stars for it.
But it was edible?
It was edible.
And how much did you spend on the meal?
$19.49, I believe.
And have you gone to several different stores in different neighborhoods?
Oh, yeah.
And how much does the food vary?
Well, some things that they have contracts for, they seem to have in every store. But it's the things like I've gotten organic blueberries there that you just stumble upon. That's part of the fun of it.
And was there anything you bought for your dinner that you ended up completely disregarding?
On the night we went to get a dinner, they did not have any fresh asparagus. They had some canned asparagus. And when we opened it up, it was just really soggy and a very unappetizing color.
I would have turned it into a risotto base.
Oh, there's your expertise speaking. I was not that
Yeah,
creative.
You can always turn anything mushy into a pasta sauce or risotto condiment. I understand that there's actually a book of 99-cent store recipes.
There is. It just came out this month, written by Christiane Jory. I have to give it up to her because she started writing this book before there was much fresh produce in the 99-cent store. And so she was really going hardcore into the canned items.
into survival cookery.
Yes. She drew on a lot of recipes from the 1960s, casseroles and these kind of things. She's already wanting to update the book now that they're having more stuff.
Now, when things are in the 99-cent store, do they ever cost less or is it just everything is 99 cents?
No, they have some things that are 3 for $0.99, some things are 59 cents.
I'm looking at this netted bag of apples and there's 3 in a pack. Do you think that sometimes one gets seduced by the idea that the food is 99 cents, but if you break it down, it's actually more expensive?
I think you get a little seduced. There's a few things I've noticed because I'm very attuned to pricing, but they sell Crystal Geyser sparkling water at the 99 cent store. I know for a fact that's 89 cents at Trader Joe's. I brought in some strawberries this morning, 8 ounces of strawberries, which sounds like a pretty good deal, but I was in Vons yesterday, and if you had their club card, they had 32 ounces for $3. But I definitely think the bargain of the day was this.
Yes, this is the La Natura Spega low-fat yogurt, the kind of yogurt that you see at Trader Joe's and also Gelson's, Ralph's. I can't believe that that was 99 cents. That was Julie Mackinnon. She is a staff writer for the business section of the Los Angeles Times. She wrote an article on making a meal of 99-cent items that we've got online at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you often find treasures on the cheap, let us know at kcrw.com/goodfood on our Good Food blog. In the spirit of Earth Day and reusing and recycling, if someone would figure out a way to make money off of cow waste, we could raise our GDP by about 1,000%. Next, turning the product of the back end of a cow into energy. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. The phrase reduce, reuse, recycle has really been taken to the next level at the Crave family farm in Waterloo, Wisconsin. George Crave, who's one of 4 Crave brothers, is here to tell us about how their farm converts the ultimate waste, cow manure, to energy. How come you have so much cow poop that you need to convert it to energy?
We milk about 900 cows on our farm here in Waterloo, Wisconsin, and the funny thing is we also have our own cheese factory, but, you know, people say, what do you make the most of, you know, milk or cheese? And I tell them, well, the most we make the most of is cow manure. It's our number one product.
And so you decided to take this number one product and do something with it.
Right. Cows consume roughly 100 pounds of food a day on a dry matter basis with the water that they consume also. They consume over 250 pounds to 300 pounds of food a day.
And how many pounds of manure does that give us per day?
You know, you squeeze a little bit of the milk and the beef out of it, and you end up with about 230 to 250 pounds of manure a day per cow.
Wow! So what are you doing with it?
Well, we capture all our manure. It's all contained in cement pits, and it goes to a 700,000-gallon fermentation tank, which is an above-ground large tank. And what happens to that manure is that it ferments and it ages and produces gas through the decomposition of the organic matter, produces methane gas. And methane is a natural, highly combustible gas, and it powers an internal combustion engine that turns a turbine that produces electricity.
So once the cow manure is in the tank and it is converting all of these combustible gases into energy, is there a lot of off-gassing? I don't know how else to put it.
Exhaust?
Yeah.
The only exhaust that comes off of this is CO2, which is you know, very environmentally friendly. So we're not creating carbon monoxide. We're not allowing the methane to escape into the atmosphere, which is a greenhouse gas. So this is very blue sky friendly.
And what do you do with the energy?
The energy is sold back to the local power utility company here, and they're able to sell that as green energy to the consumers who wish to participate in the green energy programs.
Give us an idea of how much energy you produce during the course of a year. Like, how many houses can it power?
Mm-hmm. Our capacity right now is to produce enough energy to power our modern, larger dairy farm. Also, it powers our cheese factory, and then also enough electricity to power another 80 to 100 additional homes in the neighborhood.
So do you use the energy directly for yourself, or do you sell it to the utility and then buy it back from them?
Well, this is the real crux in this situation, or in our situation, is that it's all sold back to the power company at only about 10% of the cost of what the green consumers are purchasing that energy back. Between 10 and 20% of the cost is all we're paid for. So, you know, to make this program work long-term and sustainable for other farmers to produce electricity and to really hopefully get a green revolution going, we need to have a more equitable compensation program.
So basically, the utility is turning around paying you practically nothing for the energy and then selling it for a lot higher price to consumers.
Right. They're selling it for a premium. You can sign up, at least here in Wisconsin, you can sign up to purchase green energy, which of course is a percentage of electricity that's being powering on the grid. And you will pay a premium for it, and about a 10 to 20% premium. So our problem with it is that they're purchasing this energy for only about 20% of what they're selling green energy for. So the consumers aren't really helping build green energy by purchasing green energy. Unfortunately, a lot of this is mandated, and we are not getting compensated as we should be, we feel.
And it seems like it's sort of the opposite of the ethos of what you want green energy to be, creating something that would otherwise just be wasted, instead turning it into a usable product and getting a fair price for it, but not gouging people.
Right. Well, that's all we're hoping that this will develop. Of course, we're kind of on the leading edge, or bleeding edge, as we call it, or the cutting edge, which until we get more of this energy out and have a bigger role in the energy production, as more farms introduce this type of technology, hopefully we can, you know, sometime bargain or at least have some type of leverage to demand a higher price.
Wow. It should be such a win-win-win situation. I mean, it's wonderful you're doing that, and it must feel good to at least get some benefits. But it'll be interesting to see what happens with farmers being properly compensated for creating energy that otherwise would just be going to waste. Thank you very much, George.
You're welcome.
George Crave is from Crave Brothers Daily Farm and Crave Brothers Farmstead Cheese in Wisconsin. I've got some articles on this way to create energy from waste at kcrw.com/goodfood. Earlier in the show, we talked about the practice of hiding ingredients in food or keeping ingredients a secret from the food restricted. Well, when it comes to kids and their dental health, we heard about a brilliant solution that involves giving them lollipops. More on that next when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. Imagine handing your child a lollipop to prevent dental decay and saying, here, enjoy this. UCLA microbiologist Dr. Wenyan Shi is the man whose team created the science inside each of those unusual lollipops. Explain what you do in your microbiology lab.
Okay, so we know it's the bacteria who are causing most of the dental disease, whether it's tooth decay or periodontal disease. But right now, mainly we use mechanical removal to try to control the problem. So being a microbiologist, I said we should do something better. And what we did is we tried to looking for those antimicrobial compounds who can actually killing those bacteria who are responsible for tooth decay or periodontal disease.
And are there just one or two bacteria that seem to do the most damage, or is it a whole host of them?
We now realize there's about 100 trillion bacteria, over 700 species in this little oral cavity.
That's really frightening.
But out of those 700 species, there's only a few of them are bad. I call them dirty dozen.
It's the about dirty 12. Dozen?
Yeah, it's about 12.
How far into this research did you have the aha moment when you realized that you could put antimicrobials into a lollipop?
It was actually started with a casual conversation. Yeah, you know, we've been working on this project for a while, and we screen a lot of the Chinese herbs, and we've been finding some of the herbs is very effective, and licorice is one of those on our top list. Then we're talking about how to deliver it. You know, we've been thinking about putting toothpaste, the mouthwash, varnishing, and all those kind of things. And every time we come up with an idea, and then we always deny the idea, we're saying is the compliance is going to be always a huge problem. And especially if you want to deliver those compounds to the high-risk population, which is the kids, and they always refuse to brush or taking a mouthwash. So one day, you know, idea come up, maybe we should make a sugarless candy and we deliver that. And then we actually tried a number of candy form, like a chewing gum or regular candy. And it turns out lollipop is the one takes 5 to 10 minutes to melt, which is actually the perfect timing for the compound who do their killing job.
So you mentioned licorice. Does it turn out that licorice, which a lot of us think of as candy, is one of the most effective antimicrobials?
Not every licorice candy is going to work. What we did is actually taking a licorice roots, and turns out there's about over 1,000 compounds in the licorice roots. But out of that, there's only one or two compounds we identified who actually had a specific ability to kill the carcinogenic bacteria. So what we put in the candy is actually a special fraction of the extract from the licorice. So it has to go through some special processing. On the other hand, if you look at all the older culture, like Chinese culture, Africa, or even Indian American, people have been chewing those licorice roots, you know, and by chewing
the root directly,
the roots directly, you're stimulating the saliva flow. At the same time, you also allow those active ingredients to come out of the roots. And knowingly or unknowingly, it was actually really promoting oral health.
What really fascinates me, though, is this idea of dentistry being mechanical. It seems so natural that there could be a salivary biopsy of some kind.
Well, yeah, you're right on target. Actually, this lollipop, it's a small piece of a bigger project. What we really try to do here is something I call a medical approach to dentistry. When you walk into a medical doctor's office, he will doing your urine test and a blood test, and then he will have some good idea what kind of infection you have. And in the dentistry right now was still heavily based on the experience of the dentist. He don't really have much of the biological information provided to him. All those informations, whether you're healthy or not, actually exist in the saliva. So there's this new wave of the science, you know, there's a third most important body fluid, which is the saliva, and containing a huge amount of the information, which is not only involving something tooth decay or periodontal disease or halitosis, but also provide a lot of interesting information about your systemic disease or oral cancer. So at UCLA School of Dentistry is one of the leading schools. I've been spending a lot of the time trying to figure out what's in the saliva, so allow you to actually do more of a risk assessment and the prevention instead of waiting for the disease to happen.
What do you think the reaction of the existing dental community will be? Do you think that they would want to embrace it?
Dentists is a very interesting community. They are the community actually promoting the fluoride, which is literally cutting the, you know, tooth decay rate dramatically, but they are still actually the one promoting it. You know, they finding the current approach has not been the best way to approach it. So they're really supporting this type of approach.
There's a whole community of people out there who are really bothered by this idea that there's fluoride in the water. Mm-hmm. Do you see an effect of that?
Well, given the fact that most of the toothpaste is containing fluoride, so I really don't think, you know, the drinking water have to be fluoridated. And at least in the city, there's plenty of the source of the fluoride and it would be sufficient enough. Unless somebody really abuses and using a high amount, and the negative effect of the fluoride is really minimal.
How long do you think it will be before we enter a dentist's office and get a saliva test?
As a matter of fact, there's one of the first saliva test where you're dripping the saliva and see the color changes and see what kind of bacterial infection you have. We already made such a testing kit, and it's already been in the Japanese and Europe market.
Wow.
And so we're actively working with the U.S. FDA and put it on the U.S. market as well.
Boy, I would really welcome that. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Sure.
That was Dr. Wenyan Shi. He is a microbiologist in the UCLA Department of Dentistry, and he's been part of a team who has created a lollipop that you'll actually want to give to your kids. We'll have a link to the company where you can buy the lollipops at our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. It can really seem like our food sky is falling. And following what's been going on with the massive farm bill legislation can make you so confused and frustrated. At Good Food, we've talked about the efforts of activists to alter the course of this giant program. I'll come right back with an update. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. And KCRW.com. The U.S. Farm Bill is one of those things that probably many of us don't notice, but it actually has a real impact on our day-to-day lives. The decisions made in the Farm Bill affect the crops farmers choose to grow, which of course in turn affects the choices of foods we eat and how much we pay for them. We've asked Dan Imhoff to talk with us today about the Farm Bill and the growing food crisis. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
The April 25th extension for the Farm Bill has been passed. So what is the current situation?
Well, what we had last year, the House and the Senate each made their different respective versions of this Farm Bill, this five-year plan for the food and the farming sector, which the government supports with up to $300 billion. And now, for the past few months, the House and Senate have been trying to reconcile the different elements of the bills that each of them passed in hopes of getting a bill to the president. It's been difficult. It's been difficult to find the money to pay for all the new programs that have been added. And so we've had a series of extensions as the House and Senate try to iron out these differences and find a way to get the money to give us a quote-unquote healthy food and farming system.
Are those new programs more of the kind of commodity crop subsidies that we hear about, or are these new programs that they're trying to find the money for programs that we actually think about when we hear about the words food and nutrition?
It's the latter. In the past, the way the Farm Bill has gotten through the House and the Senate is that there are times in the 1960s and 70s the hunger and nutrition communities came together and they saw this Farm Bill as a way that they could get money for these very noble and desperately needed nutritional assistance programs. So the Farm Bill pie was expanded then. The problem was this time they decided they weren't going to make the pie any bigger. So suddenly we had billions of dollars in demands for really important, worthy programs, but no way to fund them.
Because, as I understand, there hasn't been any shrinking of the subsidy part of the pie.
Exactly, of the commodity crop program, of those payments that go mainly to corn, cotton, wheat, rice, soybeans, milk, and sugar.
Was the House or the Senate bill, was one of them more consumer-friendly in terms of addressing the nutrition needs of the pie?
I think they both tried to respond. You just have to be pretty realistic about what a small sliver of the pie is actually being suggested. You know, so, for example, there was this big gain in a school snack program that the reform community was really excited about. But in actuality, it'll give about two-thirds of an apple to 10% of the kids who are lucky enough to qualify it. Two-thirds of an apple a day. I mean, it's a really small amount of money considering the great need out there.
You know, it's interesting. Here on the West Coast, we're aware that the salmon fisheries have been shut down in California and Oregon. And, you know, when you learn that the cotton that's grown in the California deserts is subsidized by the Farm Bill, so it encourages diversion of water from all those rivers that sustain the salmon, you really start to take a look at how it's so all connected now that it's hard to know where to begin to start to make changes.
Right. And for me, it all starts with conservation. That's where we have to go as we re-envision our farming and our food system for the next 50 years. How can we have farms and healthy fisheries that are creating good supplies of regional food? That's where it all starts, and that's where I'd like to see this huge ingestion of money that we have in terms of the Farm Bill to start to bring our current farming and food system up to date with what we're starting to realize.
Dan Imhoff is the author of Food Fight, The Citizen's Guide to a Food and Farm Bill. I've got some articles at kcrw.com. Good food for you if you want more info. You can find information on today's show, watch the newest video cast on Leaks, and download this show and past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can write me at goodfood@kcrw.com. I love hearing from you. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Messiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano and Ronnie Nicholson. I'm Evan Kleiman. Meet me here next week for another